Online. This is Larry Beagler.
Sorry. Steve Zinni from NETL here.
Hi, Steve.
Okay. Hi, Larry.
Okay, that's a good start. Okay. We'll wait a couple of minutes and then we'll get started.
It said there were 9 folks on the call, so there may be others out there.
Okay, very good.
ABB in Switzerland.
Okay, ABB, very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
ABB in Finland.
Okay.
ABB in Finland.
Germany.
Okay.
You have a fan club.
The Eurovision Song Contest.
Uh-huh. My thesis was sponsored by ABB Switzerland.
Ah, okay. That's a good reason. So we have everything set up, right? Okay.
Yes.
Well, let's get started then. Okay. So, welcome. It's a real pleasure to introduce the next speaker, speaker for the ESI seminar series. Glad to have the great remote turnout as well. And our speaker today is Professor Gabriela Hug from Electrical Engineering and Computer Engineering Department here at Carnegie Mellon University. She received her PhD in electric power systems from Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, and this was in 2008. And for 1 year, she was in the Special Studies Group of Hydro One Toronto. She joined us in 2009, and she also has won several awards. In particular, she had a 2-year scholarship with Daimler Chrysler in her graduate studies. She's the recipient of the ETH Medal. And the ETG Innovation Award, and then also won the ABB Research Award for her PhD thesis. Her research focuses on optimization and control in electric power systems, and this is an extremely timely topic for us in the ESI as we're trying to think about all the elements of power and energy systems and how they integrate together. So today she's going to be talking about the value of predictive control in the future electric power system. So, Gabriela, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the introduction and the invitation. It is my pleasure to give this talk today about my research. The outline of the talk is the following. Does it work?
Yeah.
I think, does it work now?
Okay.
You can keep recording.
Let's keep it.
Well, then,
okay.
Let's just keep
then,
it.
Then, let's assume it works.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's assume it works. So the outline is, I know that some of the people might not be familiar with electric power systems, so I'm going to give a short introduction into the structure of power systems and how they work. Then, as Larry said, we're currently also in a very exciting time in terms of electric power system. We're in a huge transition to the so-called smart grid. I like to call it future electric power system. Then my main research focuses on the integration of renewable generation. I'll talk about challenges, solution approaches, where I look at storage and hydropower, and then conclusion. And I have to say I'm a power systems person applying control to power systems and not a controlled person doing power systems. So my main focus is on electric power systems. So let's start with the introduction. This is the general structure of the electric power system. We have the generation, where electric power is generated. Then it's transmitted on high voltage levels closer to the consumers, to cities. And then it's transformed down to lower voltage levels and distributed in the cities to the consumers. These can be large-scale consumers, like connected to the high voltage levels, but also we as residential customers are on this lower voltage level.
Slide 5.
Oh, yeah. Should I always say when
I
move?
Could, yeah.
Okay. So a typical, what you see on slide 5 is a typical load curve, meaning that this is how much power we're using during the day. This here is a typical curve for the lower figure, is a typical curve for the residential area. We see that we have usually two peaks during the day, one during noon and one in the evening when everybody gets home, starts cooking, etc. So what you see on the right-hand side is a graph which I found on the Independent System Operator of Ontario. You see the curve, the green curve is the actual power consumption, and the blue curve is the predicted value. They do predict this in order to be able to schedule the generation for the next day. So you see that this is fairly close, but you still have some deviation. So you have to make up for the generation on a real-time basis. And the reason for this is that we have very little storage in the electric power system. Generally, demand has to be, or generation has to be equal to demand at all times. So this also means that the capacity that we need in generation is determined by the peak of the consumption. Then we come to the generation of electric energy. There are various different types of power generation. What you see here on slide 6 is solar power, hydropower, nuclear power, wind generation. All of these different types have advantages and disadvantages. Some are less costly but cause more environmental pollution. Others are less controllable, etc. So it's actually good if we have a generation mix of multiple generation sources, because this gives us the advantages of all of the sources and we can make up for the disadvantages of some of them. Now, U.S. electric energy, this is what you see here on slide 7 is the total electricity net generation by source in the U.S. So even though you might read a lot about wind generation, renewable generation in newspapers, etc., the amount that we have is still very low. Still 70% is fossil fuel-based generation, coal, petroleum, natural gas. 20% is nuclear power generation. About 10% is renewable generation, of which 66% is hydropower. This means, we roughly have about 3.5% of non-hydropower renewable generation. This is the evolution over the years, and you see that especially coal was heavily increased. So the goal now is to increase this part, the renewable generation, but enabled by the other generation types. Now, I was talking about the consumption, that we have this this varying consumption during the day. Now, this is covered by the different types of electric power generation. We have different types. So let's start at the bottom. Base load units means that they run always or most of the time. This is mostly because it's difficult to turn them off, or it takes a lot of time. It costs a lot of to actually shut them off and turn them on, such as nuclear power generation. So they basically run all the time. And then we have which cover the base load, so the minimum level. Then you have intermediate load, which somehow follow the load to a certain extent. And then we have which are usually fossil fuels, thermal power plants, biomass thermal power plants. And then we have peak load units, which follow the fast changes in load. These would be hydropower plants with storage, pumped storage hydropower plant, and gas turbine power plants. So far for the generation and the load side. Now, what we currently have is, when you read about electric power system currently in the newspaper, it's often talked about smart grid and future electric power system. So the question is, what will change? And this is the situation as we currently have it. We have, in this part, in the high voltage part, generation transmission lines, we have very high observability, meaning we have a lot of sensors, we know what's going on, we measure a lot of values. However, in the distribution system, especially in the U.S., it's not highly observable, so we have low observability. If something happens, it takes a lot of time to get it running again. And if we talk about, on slide 10, going to the transition to future electric power system, what usually, I was working for Hydro One, so their definition of smart grid or the future electric power system is simply adding communication and sensors in the lower voltage level, so in the distribution level, so that we have high observability enabled by increased communication capabilities. However, with this higher observability come a lot of additional concepts that we can apply, a lot of different capabilities that we now have. One of them is, and you might have heard about this, demand response. What that means is so far you're being charged one amount for, or during the entire day, a fixed rate for your electric power consumption. Demand response now means that you're being, and this is not the what it actually costs to produce electric power. If there's if at the peak value, the actual cost is higher than what you're paying. So the idea now here is that you're being actually charged what the generation costs, so that you will be that you have a certain incentive to actually move away from this peak. This would help to remove the peak, and so there are various different approaches to this. One is real-time pricing, so that you get like a signal every minute or so of a different price, and maybe your appliances are automated to operate only if the cost is lower than that, etc. So this would help a lot in reducing the demand. Now, another concept is plug-in electric vehicles, which means that your car is running from a battery, which you can charge at your house. Then a big topic, of course, is renewable energy in a distributed way, connected to the distribution system. So smaller units and more distributed, but also large, here you see wind farm, connected at the higher voltage levels. Another big topic in terms of research is storage devices. For example, I'm working with Jay Whitaker, who is developing a new large-scale storage device. This would decouple demand from generation. So this would allow us to go away, at least to a certain extent, from always having to generate exactly as much as we consume. This is very favorable if we talk about renewable energy, and I will talk about the challenges of these sources a little bit later as well. But renewable energy is variable and intermittent, meaning we only have that much power as we have wind, as we have sun. So the power output varies a lot, and it doesn't follow the load. So storage would allow us to store it in the storage device, the energy, and then use it when we need it. Another concept, and that's what I did my PhD thesis on, is fax devices, not HVDC, but falls basically in the same category. Fax devices help us redirect power flows in the system, or help supporting the voltage. So these are devices which we place in the system in order to influence power flows, voltages, without, for example, power flows, it would help to increase the transfer capacity, because you could place it there and then redirect power from a heavily loaded line to a less loaded line. So the goal, the general goal, is provide sustainable electric power generation to reliably supply demand at low cost. Now, coming to the main focus of this talk, which is my current research, integration of renewable generation. What you see on slide 13 is renewable generation, renewable portfolio standards. Most of the states in the U.S. have defined a certain goal and percentage which they want to reach in penetration of renewable generation. You see a lot of them are very high values. I think the largest is California, 33% by 2030. It depends on the state how this renewable generation, or what types of renewable generation they want to integrate. Often they're talking about wind, solar to a certain extent. Some states which already have a lot of hydropower, they also consider hydropower as renewable generation. Often it's not considered as renewable generation because it does have some environmental impacts if you build a dam in the river, or if you're making an artificial storage lake. So now the challenges are that, on one hand, the variability of wind and solar generation. On slide 14, you see the power output of one turbine in a one-second resolution, and I got this from papers from Jay Abt in the EPP department. So you see it's heavily changing over time. One would think that solar power is less intermittent. However, if you have a cloudy day, then it gets about this as intermittent or as variable as with the wind. I should say variability usually is considered as the short-term variations, whereas intermittency, we talk mostly about that wind generation. You have very high wind generation during the night, while it's during the day, it's pretty low, which is opposite to the loads that we usually have. So that would be intermittency. Another challenge is the optimal locations for wind generation. If you look at on slide, what's that, slide 15, the map of the U.S., and it just indicates the best locations for wind generations because we have high wind speed. So you see that particularly in central U.S., that would be the optimal location. However, that's not the place where currently the power generation is and also not where most of the people live. So the question is, how do we take benefit of these locations? And can we somehow transmit it to the actual load centers? But the transmission system obviously is not built for such a for generation at these locations. Now, at the coast, you also see a lot of red color. That will be offshore wind, which is still quite expensive. So we're mainly talking about the U.S., mainly talking about onshore wind. Now, part of the research that I'm also doing is looking at how we can use FACTS devices to increase the transfer capability of the existing system to be able to place wind generation where it's optimal and use the system that we have to bring the power to the loads. So investigating to what extent can we use it, can we use the existing transmission system. Now, solution approaches. I'm concentrating a lot on using, and that's why the title of this presentation is the value of predictive control. I'm using predictive control and look at how can we use it to optimally integrate the renewable generation by making optimal usage of the sources and devices that we already have. So one approach or one device that I'm looking at is storage devices. The goal in this is optimize the usage of the element in power systems. This means balance intermittent energy sources with optimal usage of electric storage devices, conventional energy sources, and load and demand control. So as I mentioned on slide 18, where I'm looking mainly at using predictive control. Why predictive control? The reason for this is that we now have, there are prediction tools which help us predict how much wind we will have in the next hour, next 2 hours. And you can take advantage of this. If it's predicted by weather predictions that the wind speed will drop at a certain point in time, you know that you will have to start up generation or that you have to use your storage device to make up for this loss. So what I'm doing or how predictive control generally works is that you use a map model of the plant to be controlled to predict the influence of the input. So then what you do, so you have this model and your optimizer, and then you determine the sequence which gives you the optimal outputs over a certain time. So you're optimizing not just for the current time step, but over a certain horizon. This red curve here on the right-hand side figure would be the control sequence that you have determined would be optimal for the current time step. But then you only apply the very first step because you don't know if there are any disturbances later on in the system, so you don't want to apply the entire control sequence for the entire horizon. But move the horizon by one time step and then optimize for this new horizon, which you will get a little bit deviated sequence than what you have determined before. Now, when you want to apply predictive control, you need a model of the system that you want to control. So I have here a pretty straightforward model of a storage device. Storage has a certain capacity in terms of energy. So E is the level of the energy that you have in the storage device. PSI will be the power that you're with which you're charging the storage, and PSO is the discharging power. The alpha indicates conversion losses, because if you're using storage, you don't get the entire energy that you stored out of it again. You have some losses in conversions. So the energy level at time step k plus 1 is equal to the storage level at time step k plus what you feed in times the time that you're feeding it in minus what you're discharging the storage. Constraints are limits on storage size. You have an upper capacity limit. Then you also have some limits on charging and discharging rate. So PSI and PSO are limited. This heavily, the capacity as well as the discharging and charging rate are heavily dependent on the type of storage. So if you have pumped hydro storage, if you have batteries, if you have flywheels, etc. So that heavily depends on these devices. There should be no simultaneous charging and discharging, as this is, doesn't make sense physically. So that's why you have this equation here. Then on slide 20, we see the modeling for the other generators. Conventional generators, I simply model as having a capacity limit, so I can change their output between certain limits, so 0 and PSG max. And then I also limit the ramp rate. Each of type of generation has a certain limit on how fast they can change the output. Intermittent generation, I assume that they have predictions of the output of the wind generation available so that I can use it in the predictive control. I'm allowing curtailment. That means usually you're feeding in as much as you get out of the wind generator. However, you can curtail it. This means that you're reducing the amount by a little bit. This helps you already to smoothen it slightly. But my goal, of course, is to use as much wind generation as I have. Then the load I'm modeling, because I said you're also using demand control to a certain degree. There are obviously predictions of demand available, and I'm allowing demand control, which means that I'm willing to shut off a part of the loads, or if you're using demand response, it's more with incentives bringing the load down. However, the main focus is not on curtailment and demand control. It's more on determining how do I use my storage most optimally. Now, we're coming to the optimization problem. Predictive control, you're formulating an optimization problem for the prediction horizon. So the objectives in my part, and the main objectives are the first two on slide 21, are minimize the required capacity of conventional power plants. So what you don't want to have is that you're installing a wind generation plant and you need the exact same capacity to back up this wind generation in case you don't have any wind. Then I want to minimize changes in conventional power plant output. So I want that the conventional power plants, with conventional, I just mean hydropower, thermal power plants, that they don't have to change very often and not very fast. The reason for this is that with this you are able to reduce emissions, and they're often also more efficient at a certain level or a certain output. Then minor objectives are minimizing the losses resulting from conversion in storage, curtailment, minimizing curtailment of renewable generation, and minimizing demand side management. And the equation here is simply these objectives in a mathematical form. Constraints. I have the power flow equation. That means I have a system of lines and lines which come together. So power flow equation simply means that the power injected at a certain point has to be equal to the power that is flowing out of this bus. Then I have limits on power outputs from plants and storage. So that would be these equations on slide 20. Then I have line capacities. So I was mentioning before that the problem often is that we don't have enough transmission capacity. This is because each line has a certain limit, how much power we can transmit over the line. And then we have limit on storage capacity. Now, I I have to say this is initial work, and this is for a very simple system to see what can you achieve with predictive control applied to storage. So this is a small APOL system, I think. Yeah, APOL system. What you see is on slide 22. We have a base power plant, which I assume is just having a constant output, so we don't want to change that output. Then we have here one wind generator and the second wind generator. Then we have a backup generation, which I just call that way because I say I'm changing the output of that backup generator. That will just simply be a conventional power plant, which usually will follow the load. When we have a storage here at bus 4, and we have multiple loads, bus 4, 6, 7, and 8. Now, in this test system, I assume that the base power plant generates 5 PU. For people who are not working in power system, PU just means per unit. So rather than talking about megawatts, we're talking about the per unit values. The backup power plants, I assume, have a capacity of 2 per unit. Wind generation each has a capacity of 1.5 PU, so that's the maximum output. And then the storage has a capacity of 1.5 per unit hours, which means that it could supply 1.5 per unit for 1 hour. Simulations, I have 3 different simulations, which you will see the results on the next 2 slides. Assuming I have no storage at all, then I'm assuming I have a storage device, and I'm assuming that the storage capacity is given. So I'm currently not optimizing on the storage size. A student is actually working on that, but I'm currently assuming I just have a storage given. I want to use it optimally. So storage with no predictions, just optimizing for the current time step, and storage with prediction, so n equal to 48, which would be prediction horizon of 4 hours. Simulation results. Let me first explain to you what the different graphs mean. The first graph on slide 23 is the backup generation output. The blue one is the with predictive control. The red dashed dotted one is without predictive control, so simply optimizing for one time step. And the green one would be with no storage at all. Then the second graph shows ramping of backup generation, so the difference from the previous time step to the next time step, so the changes in power output. Then the third graph is the storage level, so what is the level in the currently in the storage. Then if we go to slide 24, and I'm coming back to slide 23 after I've talked about these figures, we see on the first figure one wind generator, and on the second figure the second wind generator. It's difficult to see in the presentation I see right now, but there's a dotted line which gives the actual wind power that I would have. And at some points, for example, at the exactly at time one in the first wind generation, we see that there is quite a lot of curtailment. The third graph shows the total load. So I have a reference, and I'm doing a little bit of demand control, but you see it's almost completely fulfilled. Now let's go back to slide 23. And what you see here is that with predictive control, when you look at the blue curve, we're able to smoothen out the variations in this generator. If you compare it, if you have no storage with the green line, you see that this is much more, you have much peakier curve, and also you need a higher capacity. Now, the advantage of this predictive control is, for example, at this time step, which is shortly after day 2, I'm able to slowly ramp up my generation when I know that I'm going to have a loss of wind generation. With loss, I mean just the wind generation is dropping, so I can slowly start up wind generation, conventional generation, and I'm already at the point where I need it at the time that I need it. Then ramp rates, you see, it's much smaller than if you're using only optimization for one time step, or if you're using no storage at all. So I'm able to smoothen the backup generation output. Now, the advantage of this is that I can use other types of backup generation, which don't have that fast of a ramp rate. So this would actually enable generations. Usually you would use very fast generation, like natural gas, to balance the wind generation. With this, you can also use other power plants. And then on the third graph, I said you see the energy levels of the storage. And the advantage with predictive control with the blue curve is that you see that the time that the storage is completely empty and completely full are rather short. So I know that I'm using my storage in an optimal way. On the slide 24, there is sometimes wind curtailment necessary simply when there's too much wind generation compared to the load and the storage is already full. However, if I'm using predictive control, I'm able to equalize the curtailment over a certain time. For example, if you're looking at day 5 in the first figure here, you see that the blue curve is straighter than if I have no storage or only optimizing for one time step. So far for the storage device. Started working on is another approach on looking at what could hydropower do in integrating renewable generation. However, I have to say that my goal is that at the end to combine everything. It is my belief that it's not going to be just one solution. It's not just going to be storage. Some people work on using demand response for balancing wind generation. So I think it takes multiple things and you can or multiple concepts and multiple devices, and you can take benefit from all of them. So another approach that I'm taking is looking at hydropower. There are different, on slide 26, you see different types of hydropower. We have run-of-river power plants, which are power plants which are built into the river, and they don't have or only very little storage lake upstream of them. You can see that there's a powerhouse where the turbines and the generators are located. So the water is flowing through the turbines, which drives the generator, and electricity is generated. Then we also have the weirs, and the weirs are like gates or flaps which you can open to just let water pass. Then in many places, there's a rule that operators of run-of-river power plants have to comply with, keeping at a certain point in the river upstream of their plant, keep the water level between certain limits. So they're not allowed to flood the area upstream of them or completely emptying it. Another type is storage power plants. So if you have a storage lake, and again, you have powerhouse and the weirs. So this gives you more flexibility. It's like a storage. And then you have pumped hydropower plant, which means that we're pumping water from a lower reservoir into a higher reservoir, using the potential or storing it basically as potential energy, and then using it at times when we need it to generate electric power. Now, what I'm mainly working on is, well, the pumped hydropower I can consider as storage, so that's basically covered by what I've already talked about. I'm also looking at run-of-river power plants and power plants where you have a storage lake. Now, the difference between pumped hydropower plants and storage power plants is that the storage power plant is also built into the river, so there's water coming in and water flowing out. So on slide 27, I'm looking at how could we use run-of-river power plants for balancing renewable generation or wind generation. And we do have a lot of run-of-river power plants, and also from the country where I'm from Switzerland, we have a lot of run-of-river power plants. And if you're looking at the cascade of river power plants, you're able to use them to a certain amount or a certain degree to actually balance the wind generation. Now, the difference between a river and just a water tank is retention, which means that if you have a certain water discharge through the plant, and the same water discharge obviously coming into at a certain point in the river, then you have a very distinctive water line over the river. You can calculate that by the Solnit-Nell equations, which I will introduce on the next slide. And this measurement point indicates the point where I said that the operator have to keep the limit between certain, or the water level between certain limits. So that will be a measurement point like this. Now, if you do have a cascade of multiple river power plants, you see that by being able to vary this water level at the measurement point to a certain degree, you do have some kind of a storage, even if you don't have a storage line. So I'm trying to take advantage of this. Objectives are to minimize the changes in total power output, so some of hydropower plants and wind power, minimizing discharge variations at the power plants, because you don't want to constantly ramp up and down the turbines at the hydropower plants. Reasons mainly because of the environment, of boats on the river. Minimize deviations of water levels from the reference value, so keeping this measurement point as close as possible to the reference value, and especially keeping it within the limits. Now, the advantage of predictive control is that I can define this, keep within with limits, use this as an explicit constraint in my optimization problem. That's one of the big advantages. Now, I first need to model the flow in the river in order to be able to know if I change the output at the hydropower plant, the river power plant, how much will my water level at this measurement point change. This measurement point might not be right upstream of the river power plant, but some 100 meters upstream. So how do I influence it? And as this is a very slow system, water flow is quite a slow system, you can use the so-called Solnit-Nell equations on page on slide 28 to model this. These I won't go into details. These are the partial differential equations that can be used to derive actually linear equations, which can be integrated into predictive control. They're derived from conservation of momentum and conservation of volume in the river. So if you look at these equations and you look at the list here, on so W is the river width at the water surface, H is the water height from riverbed, etc., you see that this involves knowing what the topology of the river. So you need this data in order to be able to use this model. Now, water height from riverbed and discharge through the cross-section, these are the variables which are changing in my system. I'm trying to predict what's happening, especially in the water level, using these equations. Now, on slide 29, what I end up with, if I linearize it and discretize it, is this linear system for river flow. So I get this general linear system for as my model, and my states of this model are the water levels and discharges at certain distinctive points along the river. My control variables U are, or the control variables are the water discharges or water flow through the river power plants. Q in is considered to be a disturbance. It's the water flow that I'm getting into this part of the river. However, if I have the river power plant at this point here, then it's also a control variable. Outputs are my so-called concession levels, so the level that I want to keep constant, and the discharge through the water. The variables that I'm using as control variables are the changes in the river power plant, and the output is the actual discharge. Now, I can translate water discharge to electric power by the equation at the bottom of slide 29. It gives the relation between the discharge QT and the power that is generated. It's a very general equation, which is it's the efficiency times the weight of the specific weight of water times the height across the river power plant and the gravitational force. Okay, now we come to the problem formulation. We have an objective function, and is that normal?
Hello?
Oh, that's okay.
So the objective function includes, again, minimizing discharge changes at the river power plants, minimizing level deviations, and smoothen. And the main focus is on smoothen wind power generation. Constraints are the river flow model, obviously, that I introduced on the previous slide, and constraints on the water level and turbine rear discharges. So now we're coming to simulation results, which are more interesting than the derivation of the problem. I'm looking at the cascade of four runoff river power plants, each of them 20 kilometers apart. So you see here on slide 31 a very simple visualization. The HC values are the values that I want to keep constant. The operating point is 3,000 cubic meters per second, whereas 1,200 cubic meters per second go through the weirs. Water level constraints, I want to keep them between plus minus 12 centimeters. Weir discharge and inflow, I assume as constant. So the Q in is constant 3,000 cubic meters per second, because I'm looking at, I think I have a simulation for 6 days. And I have the weir discharge at constant to 1,200 cubic meters per second. Then if you're using predictions, and that's what I'm using for wind generation, you will always have prediction errors. So in this simulation, I assume that I have a 10% root mean square prediction error. This is fairly low. The reason for that is I'm also working in parallel to this here, or assuming that you have small storage devices local to the wind generation with which you can keep it constant, the total power output constant to 5 minutes. So with this, you're able to reduce the prediction error, and that's why I'm assuming 10% root mean square prediction errors. Then you have 2 hours prediction horizon with a 5 minute resolution. These are the simulation results for the generation. You see on slide 32, there's the green curve shows the predicted wind generation, and the, I'm not sure what color it is, the dashed dotted line in black probably is the actual wind generation that I will get. Then the blue curve is what I determine as the optimal hydropower output, which of course is dependent on the discharge of the hydropower plant. So I'm actually determining the discharge at the river power plant. And this is the red curve is the total generation. So what you see is that I'm able to smoothen the power output. So the variability of what you see in the black curve is gone. However, what you see here is also that I'm not able to overcome the intermittency. So during the day, I still have much lower generation output than at night. You would need either storage lakes or larger cascades of river power plants in order to do this. But this indicates that you can already do quite a lot if you use hydropower plants, river power plants. So on the next slide, 33, you see the water levels, and I promise to keep them between plus minus 12 centimeters. These are the water levels at the four different river power plants. And you see by predictive control, I'm able to do so because I can include it as an explicit constraint, and I have the model to predict how the water level will behave. Before I'm coming to the conclusion, I should say this is not how it is determined. Who is producing how much generation. This is an approach looking at centralized control and being able to tell this generator, you do this. This is not how it works. Currently, especially in the US, it's on determining electricity markets. With this work, I just want to show how much you could do, how much you could achieve with it. And what I'm also trying to find out, and I'm talking to different people working in electricity markets, is how could we integrate something like this into electricity markets? For example, by giving the river power plants a certain incentive to do this, This is work for the future. It simply shows how much you could do with the, or what's the capacity or the capability of your power plants in this regard. So coming to the conclusion on slide 34, electric power systems field is currently in a major transition. You read it in the newspaper all the time. However, major challenges need to be resolved. Predictive control allows for full exploitation of device potentials if we really could apply it centralized. As I said, I'm working on integrating it in the actual process of determining which generator is determining how much or producing how much. Storage reduces the need for fast ramping backup generation and the required ramp rates if optimally controlled. Existing hydropower provides already large storage capacity, which currently might not be optimally used. Coordination achieves overall optimal performance. Additional information, which we have in the future electric power system because we're extending communications, would enable such a coordination. Integration of intermittent renewable generation, I believe, asks for a hybrid solution, not just looking at we just use storage or we just use gas turbines, et cetera, to balance the variability. But it's an open question, and it's not just technical. It's also looking at what's more cost-effective. Then the question is, how do you determine cost? Is it just financial? Do you also take into account environmental costs, et cetera? So, it's a complex question. So I thank you for your attention, and I'm open for your questions.
So perhaps if I could get questions remotely, are there any questions out there? Okay, if not, questions from the audience here? Yes, Sebastian.
I understand from the examples and everything that you're looking at storage mostly at the generation side, more or less. But do you see that there's any... would make any sense to try to see if the storage did some more point, like maybe at the end consumer?
The approach that I'm taking is looking at various locations. Actually, I have a student who just now in January started working on different applications of storage and location of storage. You're right, there are different options. You can have it at the generator. You could use the storage to artificially increase or decrease the ramp rates of generators. You could have it as large-scale storage devices somewhere at the substation.
Yeah.
You could have it distributed at the consumer. And I don't have an answer. What would be the I believe that it would make sense to have local storage devices at the wind generator to balance the fast variability of the generators. And then have large-scale storage device for further...
The reason I ask is, I understand it's not part of the scope now, but if you consider reliability, because we do something with storage and reliability, mm-hmm. then it makes sense to look at different... the reliability consideration should be taken into account for the storage. So, for me, it's an interesting problem. That's not a problem.
Can you comment on the nature of the optimization model for the predictive control? Looked like the objective function was quadratic. But
in this case, it was quadratic.
Are they linear or are they
non-linear? For the hydropower problem, so far it's linear. In the storage, it's also DC power flows in that case. Well, you do have a non-linear equation.
Sine-Vernand equations.
Well, the sum and all question I'm linearizing. So,
I'm
positive for the hydropower problem. It's a quadratic objective function with linear equations. In this case here, I do have it's a linear model. However, you have one nonlinear equation. But as soon as you go towards, and here I'm using DC power flow, which means I'm using only active power flows on lines. As soon as you go towards AC power flow, it gets nonlinear. So as I'm including the power flow equations, as soon as you go to AC power, it becomes nonlinear. But in this case, it's linear except for this one equation.
Okay. Sumit?
have a question. So you mentioned demand response as one of the ingredients of the future in our system. So my question, so you also pointed out that you have high observability in the say, upstream part and low observability in the downstream part. But isn't that only true for, let's say, the home appliances, for instance? What about industrial processes? There's a lot of instrumentation already out there. What is the potential for those processes?
Actually, industrial customers sometimes even already have demand response, while we at home are, at least in Pennsylvania, we don't have it yet. So there is, it's highly debated, because industrial customers, they're big customers, so you can install a meter there and you do have some potential. However, if you look at the costs of installing a smart meter at the residential house, it's not sure if it really makes up the cost or the benefits of it. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not focusing very much on demand response, and the reason for this is that I think it will be difficult to convince consumers to shift when they wash their clothes and so on. I just think electricity is too cheap to actually do something with demand response unless you are a very big customer. Where it affects, like CMU, for CMU it probably would make sense because electricity bill, I assume, is pretty high. But I don't think for the residential that it makes sense. But I think this is still, it's still research needed in finding out what the actual benefits are. Did that answer the question? I'll answer
it. Okay. Alex?
Yeah. How do you air in your demand forecast impact your storage energy
for bottles? I can give the example. Turn it off, yeah. And if I would have perfect predictions, this would be even smoother, so you wouldn't have things like this here. So you do see an improvement or a deterioration in performance if you have prediction errors. However, it's not if you go to like larger prediction errors that you get like a extremely bad performance. You see a worse performance, of course, because you're making assumptions of the future which are not true. But in terms of performance, I don't see that much of a deterioration. And one of the reasons is feedback that you have after each control step.
Have some kind of state?
If I have?
State
yes. For, oops, too fast. Yeah, on slide 29, we see the river model. So I'm not measuring all of these values. So I'm using a common filter, too. If I just measure the one of the water levels and the discharges. So, yes, I'm using an estimator. And yeah, I didn't mention that I also introduced some errors in the river topology. So I don't say that I know exactly how wide the river is. So there are also errors in. And yeah, with the state estimation, you're also taking care of being able to estimate the other variables, not by measuring the entire river.
Don?
In your quadratic objective for the predictive controller, you had a number of weights.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that there was some sensitivity to those weights, or
yeah.
You selected those?
There is sensitivity. For example, if I chose, and I did different test runs. If I choose for the minimization, this row WQ on slide 30, if I choose that very big, then I will see less variations in discharge output, obviously, and it will not get as smooth as it does in my simulation. So I put the main way. So WG is the highest, or for me, is the highest importance. So what I also do is, for example, if you look at the cascade of river power plants on slide 31, it's more important to have a steady discharge at the fourth power plant than at the first power plant, because I can balance it with the second power plant. So I put a higher weight on not having that many discharge variations on the fourth power plant than on the first one. So you can even vary for different power plants, but also between different objectives. Yeah, you do see a sensitivity.
But there was a lot of trial error.
Yeah, in this case, it was trial error. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, yes, last question. Yeah.
I wonder if what you're modeling the constraint where you cannot have input and output of the storage tank simultaneously with a bilinear kernel process. I wonder if there's maybe a better way of doing it. At least, I know that there are binary variables, you might not want to do an integer for one approach. But I mean, you know,
yeah, that certainly would be, especially from optimization experts, that would help to get some feedback. I just took the most straightforward approach. I've discussed it with a colleague, and it serves our purposes. But I'm aware that this is not the optimal situation, that optimal approach.
Okay. All right. If no other questions, let's thank our speaker again. Okay, thank you very much, Gabriela. Okay, and thank you all for listening, and that concludes the seminar, and it will be archived. Thank you. Okay.